The Athletic.
Hello, welcome to the Athletic Football Tactics Podcast, where each week the Athletic's sharpest footballing minds and deepest thinkers join me, Ali Maxwell, to discuss the trends, the data, and the tactical systems behind the biggest footballing stories. I'm joined today by the Athletic's tactics writer, Michael Cox, and football analytics writer, Mark Carey. But also, last week, we spoke to the brilliant James Horncastle, who guided us through Italy and Serie A. And as promised, now we are on to Spain. The Spanish football writer for The Athletic, Dermot Corrigan, will help us make sense of what's happening in La Liga this season. We'll speak to Dermot in just a bit. First, hello to the regulars. Mark Carey, I think I can start calling you that now. It's your fifth appearance on the podcast, but we can't ignore what they're whispering about in the media circles, that Warville's departure to Leipzig opens up your own pathway to more frequent appearances, more regular minutes on the podcast. Of course, with great opportunity comes pressure to perform. How are you doing?
Yeah, good, thanks. I think it's one of those, it's like, the king is dead, long live the king, whereby we haven't even had time to mourn Tom's departure, but I'll certainly try and do my best to fill his shoes in at least the short term.
And excitingly, it's been confirmed, Mark, who the Athletic have hired to fill Tom's boots, John Muller, who I think we're all very excited to be working with.
Yeah, delighted to be joined by John. He's been in the office already, had some great chats with him, and hopefully he'll be able to come on the podcast soon as well. I think he's certainly interested in doing more and more of that. But I think, yeah, one step at a time, let's get him all set up and ready to go first. But he's got a really good, interesting piece that's coming out very soon as well, so look out for that.
Many of the listeners will know him from the Space newsletter, which he has been running, writing some fascinating stuff around data and its use within football. Welcome, John. I'm sure we'll be speaking to him soon. Michael, how are you doing this week?
I'm very well, thank you. Enjoying this international break. I think this is a fun one because stuff is happening. Teams are qualifying. Teams are going out. Could also give a shout out to a lad called Jack, who I met at Royston 1, Kingstonian 1 on Saturday afternoon. He came over and said hello and was very complimentary about you as well, Ali. So
was he really?
Yep.
Interesting.
I was surprised as well, but there you go.
Shout out, Jack. Not exactly a quiet week for you on the writing front, though, Michael. You decided to write about, that's right, falsehoods surrounding the playing style of English football's most successful football manager, Sir Alex Ferguson. The article titled, "Don't Judge Solskjaer on Fergie's Attacking Philosophy, It Didn't Really Exist." Where did this one come from?
Well, it came from watching all the punditry over the last two or three years about Manchester United, I suppose. I mean, to be honest, one of our editors actually asked, you know, have you ever written an article about the players who played under Ferguson at Manchester United and how they haven't really been successful as managers? And I thought, well, maybe the more interesting thing is actually the style, considering we've heard so much about this, you know, Solskjaer has been accustomed to the attacking style of play at Manchester United. And when you think about it, I mean, none of them really have been renowned for their attacking football. I think Ryan Giggs probably is a bit of an exception. I think what he's done at Wales, he's clearly incorporated more attacking players than they were used to under Chris Coleman. But the rest of them, I think, have been quite defensive and tried to grind out wins, as I think Manchester United did for a lot of time in 1990. So, yep, that's up on the site now. And also there's an article today about the second phase of set pieces. I think a lot of goals have come from that in this season's Premier League so far, where the defending team clears the first ball to the edge of the box, there's another cross into the box, and then there's a goal. It just seems quite a chaotic situation, quite difficult to defend. There's no real set strategy for it. So had a look at that as well.
Brilliant. That's all on the Athletic site for your reading pleasure. Time to welcome Dermot Corrigan to the podcast. Dermot, how are you? How's things in Spain?
Hey, Ali, everybody. Yeah, pretty good. Pretty fun international break for Spain as well. Was down to Seville to see them against Sweden, which was fun. First time I've been to Cartuja, the quite odd stadium down in Seville. They have two really good stadiums in the city that they could play games in, but they play in the third Athletic Stadium. But it was fun, and Spain got through, so it was a good weekend.
Of course, La Cartuja was where Spain played Sweden in their first Euro 2020 group stage game. Now, that's only 5 months ago, and I think I'm right in saying they were somewhat booed and whistled during that game. The home fans not pleased with what they saw from Luis Enrique and his team in that game. But fast forward 5 months, it has been a roller coaster for the Spanish national team and for Luis Enrique. And this week they qualified for the World Cup next year in Qatar. It feels like from that moment on, Dermot, public approval rating for Luis Enrique has been on a pretty steady incline.
Yeah, like Luis Enrique is such an interesting character. He's not well liked around Real Madrid, which meant that he wasn't so well liked by quite a big portion of the Spanish fans, the Spanish media as well. He's not somebody who courts the media, it's fair to say. So that all built into the reception that they got. Morata as well, who's such another kind of interesting character. He was whistled during the Euros. But suddenly Spain kind of came from nowhere, or this new Spain team came together to play. You know, they're capable of like some fantastic football. You know, maybe you can reach peaks that other international teams or very few international teams can reach, but they're also capable of like chaotic, shambolic defending, missing penalties, you know, getting into awful mess. So they're kind of fun team to watch. They're a young team, so it's been fun. And along the way, somehow they've kind of caught. Not, I wouldn't say everybody is behind Luis Enrique, and at this stage he still has some anti-Luis Enriquistas around. But his name was being chanted at the stadium at the end of the game on Sunday. They did a lap of honor. It was kind of weird because before the game, Spain were kind of in trouble. You know, if they lost, they were into the playoffs, which was going to be tough. But there was still a kind of party atmosphere, Mexican wave in the stadium, a lot of younger fans, different fans. Maybe similar for other countries, that your typical Spain fan is different from your typical La Liga fan. So partly I was wondering, do they understand what's at stake here or what's going on? But by the end, everybody was happy and there was a bit of a party at La Cartuja.
Michael, I read Dermot's brilliant piece breaking down Spain's qualification for the World Cup. And I mean, despite using a scarcely believable 43 different players across his 8 qualifying matches, it also, I got the sense that he is attempting to and getting quite close to achieving the sort of style of play, tactical identity that's difficult for international managers to achieve. But Enrique's really going for it despite such chopping and changing of personnel. How would you characterise their tactical style?
Yeah, it's funny with the personnel. I mean, I think he has chopped and changed probably too much, but I think it does speak, you know, it does say something about the kind of quality Spain have. I think they've got a lot of depth compared to other national teams, but they maybe don't have that many standout players. I mean, really, who are the real world-class players in this Spain side? Probably fewer than 10 years ago, 15 years ago, 20 years ago. And therefore, I don't think there's many players who absolutely command a place in the side. But you're right, despite that chopping and changing, there is a clear style. I mean, I think it's, to generalise a bit, it's very Spanish. It feels very Spanish when you watch it. I mean, when Enrique took over at Barcelona, I thought his style of football there was considerably more direct, really, than the style that Guardiola had played. I think there was more emphasis on getting the ball quickly to the forwards on the run. But, I mean, when I've seen them in this qualification process, they've been incredibly patient with the ball. I saw the game against Sweden, the 1-0 win that took them through. I thought there was a real lack of penetration there. You know, they had so much of the ball, they didn't create many chances. It's maybe not a fair game to judge on, because at the end of the day, they did need a draw. And therefore, playing out a fairly tame 0-0 almost felt like their priority. In the end, they got a slightly fortunate winner. They're a funny team. I never fancied them to score more than twice against the minnows. And yet, when it comes to the big games against good sides, I think they are well suited to that challenge. I mean, that semi-final against Italy in the summer, I thought they were the better side and very unlucky to lose that on penalties, obviously. So yeah, they're a funny side. I think there's some areas of concern. I never really fancied the centre-back partnership. I think they always look a bit uncomfortable covering space in the channels. There were a few mistakes in the last couple of games in terms of playing out from the back. I know there's been a suggestion that the midfield is often formatted in a bit of a cautious way, which is interesting with Gavi and Pedri now on offer, the two young Barcelona lads, but I'm not sure they'll play together in the same team for the foreseeable future. So, yeah, they're a funny team. I think of all the teams, you know, going forward to the World Cup from UEFA, I think they'll maybe be the most interesting side in a tactical sense. But I'm still haven't been completely convinced by them in this qualification process.
We'll certainly be talking about Gavi and Pedri later on. And Luis Enrique has, what, about exactly a year now to whittle down 43 to 23 or maybe 26. I'm not sure how big the squads can be in next year's World Cup. And we will be keeping a close eye on that. But next, it's time to dive into La Liga. We'll be talking, amongst other things, about Vinicius Jr. and Ancelotti's Real Madrid with Dermot next. Dermot, if we may, let's start our La Liga analysis with the state of play at the top of the division, because it's notable to me that we have Real Sociedad top of the league, and Real Madrid and Sevilla a point behind. Both of those teams have played a game fewer than La Real. We're talking about Ancelotti's Real Madrid in more depth later on. So could you talk me through how Real Sociedad and Sevilla have put themselves among the early pace setters?
Super open La Liga this year. Barca are in crisis. I guess we'll get to them. Madrid definitely in transition. And Atletico have been leaking goals, which we might talk about as well, that it's not the kind of machine Atletico for sure that people might have expected. So La Real have taken advantage. And they're a really interesting team, because just have a piece up on the site today on the Athletic about Xabi Alonso. We went to talk to him and talk to some other people in the La Real youth system at Zubieta there about how they bring through. And most of the squad, like 18 of the squad, I think, have come through the youth system there. There's a lot of young local Basque players who they've developed. The coach as well, Imanol Alguacil, he was a former B team coach, former D team player. Everything it's very kind of in-house. People, you know, Athletic Bilbao are the standout Basque team that everybody kind of knows about at this stage, that they use all Basque players. La Real, they open up a bit wider. They take in, like, they have Isak playing up front, they have David Silva in midfield, but they still have a real local core and a real kind of all-together kind of ethos. And they don't have standout stars at all either. A lot of the team players can come in and out, but they play good football. Imanol has them really well organised at the back. Last season, they used to they conceded too many goals. This season, they've been very tight at the back, kept a lot of clean sheets. And they've been the most impressive team so far. They're not super exciting to watch. They're not super entertaining. A lot of their games are 1-0, 2-0. But they're getting the job done. And winning the title is going to be difficult for them. But they have a really good chance of making it into the Champions League, which is going to mean that another team, and again, Barcelona, might struggle to get into the top four.
Michael, it doesn't escape me that last season, early on, I think probably 9 or 10 games in, we did a whole podcast on the fast starters, the overachievers, I think we framed it as, across Europe. And we spoke about Real Sociedad having started the season very well in Spain.
Yeah, it was 26 points from their first 13 games last season. It's 28 this time around, so they're two up on last year. Yeah, they're an interesting side. I mean, might become a bit of a theme with this podcast, but a little bit like Spain, they've chopped and changed quite a lot in terms of the lineups. They're sometimes quite difficult to keep up with who's going to play. A bizarre statistic I found is that they've scored 19 goals in the league this season. No one has got more than one assist. So there's no real prime source of creativity, as you might expect for a side with David Silva in the ranks. They're really sharing it around, but and they're kind of sharing the goals around as well. I mean, Alexander Isak had an incredible season last time out, 17 goals in the league. He's not really been firing on all cylinders so far this time around. I thought he was pretty tame in that game against Spain as well the other day, actually. But yeah, they're an interesting side. Good to, maybe not as good to watch as some of the other sides in La Liga, but they are, as Dermot says, they get the job done. And the thing I always find interesting when I watch Real Sociedad's home games is the job they've done with that ground. I know it's a bit off topic, but I went there when there was a massive running track around the edge, and now it's been converted into a really nice, tight, proper football ground. It just feels like a completely different arena.
Mark, the big question about surprise fast starters, surprise pace setters, is it sustainable? What can the numbers tell us about that?
Yeah, I think it's one of those when they say about sort of if you're actually going to have mount a realistic challenge for the league, that you have to have first and foremost a strong defence. And as Dermot said, that's certainly what they've done and what they've got in the early parts of the season. I think they've only conceded 10 goals all season. I know they've played a game more than some others around them, but that's the third best defensive record in La Liga, which is similar form to what they had at the early parts of last season as well. It's just, I guess, a case of sustaining it now. But at the other end, as you say, they're sort of sharing the goals around, but I think that they need to keep Mikel Oyarzabal fit. I think he's got a muscle injury at the moment, I believe. Dermot will be able to tell me better, but he's their leading scorer at the moment. And I think he's taken three penalties so far this season, but he actually has the best expected goals per 90 of any player in La Liga at the moment. So 0.77 per 90. So that's the sort of rate. He's getting chances of three goals every four games. Probably unsustainable, still very early days. But even if you take the penalties out of that, he's still got a rate of about 0.45 non-penalty expected goals. So we're kind of a one in two rate. So I think if they're going to mount a challenge, they need to keep him fit.
And what about that team locked on points with Real Madrid, Dermot? Sevilla, you were in the city this week. How excited are Sevilla fans about their start to the season?
Sevilla fans are in a weird place at the minute because last year, under Lopetegui, in his first season, they won the Europa League. Second season, they put in quite a decent title challenge. They were never really top of the table, but they were up until three or four games towards the end of the season. They were at Real Madrid and drew a real game they might have won, and that would have put them back into it. So this year, everybody was like, okay, we're set. They brought in Thomas Delaney, Eric Lamela, you know, experienced players, not guys who, you know, from Seville's point of view, we're thinking like we could win stuff with these guys. Champions League campaign has not gone well at all. Delaney has been a bit of a, well, I was going to say disaster, but he's just been involved in a lot of unfortunate incidents, getting sent off, giving away penalties. Lamela has scored a couple of goals, but not done much. And he keeps chopping and changing as well, Lopetegui. But having said that, they're still right up there in La Liga because it is such a unusual La Liga season so far. They've been grinding out results. I haven't been to the Sanchez-Pizjuan this season to see them. I've just caught some of the games on the TV. But they're kind of well positioned without causing any waves, without doing too much, making too much excitement. I think that they're sticking in there and they're definitely looking well for top four. And I guess it depends whether one of the big teams can get their act together, whether Madrid maybe can pull away. Because if 80 points is enough to win La Liga this season, then Sevilla have a decent chance of getting there, I think.
I promise I'm not just going to read off kind of assist stats throughout this podcast, but Sevilla have scored 21 goals. Navas has got two assists and no one else has got more than one. Don't really understand how this is possible. What's going on? Spain used to be full of prolific assisters. How are they sharing it around to this extent? Remarkable.
I love this statistic chat already. This is great. I think Sevilla are, and Dermot, again, you'll be able to sort of correct me if I'm wrong here, but they do have a good foundation in defence first and foremost. And I think it was similar last season. I think you and I might have done a piece together, which they're not going to be able to compete with the likes of Barcelona and Real Madrid from an attacking sense, but Madrid and Barcelona have also leaked goals at the back. But it seems like they are just kind of ticking along and just keeping those wins quite tight or the results quite tight. And it's first and foremost built upon a strong foundation in defence.
They have that triangle of Koundé and Diego Carlos, the centre-back, and Fernando in front of them, which is really important. Koundé had a weird summer because he wanted to go to Chelsea. Probably would have gone to Chelsea if Chelsea had paid what Sevilla were looking for. There was a little bit of Barney between the two clubs, kind of pointing fingers at who was to blame. But he didn't go on strike, but wasn't fully mentally there for the first couple of weeks of the season. But he's come back in. Diego Carlos went through a bit of a dip in form and he's come back. And Fernando's just been amazing for Sevilla. He's been, you know, one of the best players in La Liga over the last couple of years and he's super important to them. Just kind of holds them together in the midfield. So they do have that solid basis. And at fullback, they've been really good as well. Acuña is one of the most creative players in the team. Lopetegui is a very kind of functional coach. It's a very machine-like type of a Sevilla team. And in what Michael's saying there as well, similar at Real Sociedad, the pieces come in and out. It's very difficult to predict what the Sevilla lineup is going to be. En-Nesyri got injured, which is a blow to them. Maybe that's why they haven't scored as many goals. And he's kind of streaky player as well. But they've been kind of rolling with the punches and they've been doing enough to stay in there. Again, we'll see maybe in January they might look to bring in another striker. There's talk of Luke de Jong coming back from Barcelona, which might solve a couple of problems at different ends. But it's just wide open. And if Sevilla are going to, you know, win La Liga, I think it's the 1930s, maybe the last time that they've won La Liga title. It's a super opportunity for them. And if they get knocked out of the Champions League, maybe that clears the way as well. I'm not sure that they want that to happen, but it might be a help in that way.
Well, of course, Real Madrid are lurking amongst them. They are the current favourites for the league title. Their odds at the moment imply a 64% probability at this point. Michael Ancelotti back in the dugout at the Bernabeu. How's he setting them up tactically this time around?
I mean, it's very Ancelotti, I would say. It's 4-3-3. The players are roughly in the expected positions. I don't think there's been any significant revolution, although there has been a change at centre-back with Ramos and Varane leaving. David Alaba's come in there. I guess maybe he's the interesting one in terms of you know, you could field him in various positions, but Ancelotti's gone for him at centre-back. But yeah, the midfield's very familiar, and they're kind of looking for individual magic from the forwards. I mean, Vinicius has stepped up this season, but Benzema is doing the kind of Messi-esque thing of leading the league in both goals and assists. And yeah, we've spoken about Benzema before, I think, but yeah, he is in the form of his life. You know, since Ronaldo left, he's stepped up a level, and I think now, if he wasn't already talked about in these terms, I have to consider him one of the best players in the world. I'd say it's not a particularly kind of structured or methodical team, but he's just in fantastic form.
Yeah, 10 goals, I think, in La Liga this season already. And I think at the team level, I think, as you say, Michael, they are kind of relying on individuals. And if they've got players in the ilk of Benzema, they can rely on them because they are such quality players, especially in their finishing. And they are running a little bit hot at the moment in terms of their statistics side of things. So in terms of their expected goals and their goals scored, they've actually scored just over 8 more goals than they should have based on the chances that they found themselves in. And I think they've also, at the other end as well, just conceded ever so slightly fewer than you would expect, again, considering the chances that they've conceded. So running a little bit fortunate, their underlying numbers maybe aren't as strong as maybe their actual goals scored and conceded. But yeah, I mean, they'll be very grateful for that, but it's just whether or not that will continue.
The feeling around Madrid, talking to a couple of people around the squad for a piece doing on Eden Hazard, which is coming out soon, and also being at the stadium a couple of weeks ago, the fans were whistling them. You know, they've been winning games 1-0. The Clásico, going into the Clásico, Ancelotti was coming under a bit of pressure. You know, they lost to Sheriff in Europe. They lost at Espanyol. They weren't scoring many goals. They're so reliant on Benzema and Vinicius, but it's kind of individual or that partnership more than anything else, more than the team structure or the team is doing really well. So Ancelotti might have been under more pressure if Barca weren't, you know, falling apart and taking away the focus. And the teams around Madrid, well, you know, people kind of just assume, you know, it's interesting that Ali says as well that they're super favourites to win the title. That's almost because everybody's like, well, it's not going to be a vintage season. Madrid are going to kick into gear. They have Modric and they have Kroos and they have these players, which, you know, they're probably right. It is the most likely thing to happen. But it's not, there's not a sense of excitement around Madrid at the moment, or a feeling that Ancelotti has done, you know, has come in with a new plan that he's going to shake things up, or they're in transition, but they're not sure where they're trying to get to, or they're still kind of waiting for Mbappe maybe to arrive, and we'll see whether that happens or not. But again, that opens it up for if it's Real Sociedad or Sevilla or somebody else to come through.
That's really interesting. In terms of those two high-performing individuals at the top of the pitch, I mean, we discussed Benzema and his whole career the other week in depth. He's having a remarkable season, particularly given his longevity at the very top level, that he can still perform at this level. How about Vinicius Jr.? I'm really interested to know what your take on him is, Dermot, because only Benzema has scored more goals in the whole of La Liga than Vinicius. And for someone who's been at Real Madrid for a few years, but of course from such a young age, is this now him making the leap to becoming one of the top players in his position, which was kind of what he was always anointed for upon his move to Real Madrid?
Yeah, it's a total mystery, really. Like, myself and Mark looked at it as well. I looked at the figures, and his XG was well up on, or he was scoring a lot more than he was supposed to, really, based on the chances that he had. And speaking to people around the squad as well, you know, it's just like a click that he used to get into great positions. He had all the talent. He was a super entertaining dribbler, you know, really, really entertaining player to watch, but didn't have that end product. And then suddenly this season, he started the season on the bench. Hazard and Bale were the starting wingers for the first game of the season for Ancelotti. Then Vinicius comes off the bench, scores two brilliant goals in Levante when Madrid are in trouble and end up drawing the game 3-3. And his confidence is just through the roof. And suddenly the ability that he had, you could always see that naturally, he was supernaturally talented, but he's put it together. And, you know, some of the flicks, some of the understanding with Benzema as well, because there was an idea, which I guess has turned out to be unfair, that he wasn't he didn't have the same understanding of the game that players like Benzema and Kroos and Modric have. And so sometimes you'd see it in the stadium, everybody be throwing their hands up in desperation, kind of. He'd run the wrong way, or he'd give the wrong pass, or he'd shoot when he wasn't supposed to. This season, he's just not doing that. Ancelotti has, it's not, it's a typical Ancelotti thing. It's not like a masterstroke that he's done loads of individual work with him on the training ground in a kind of Guardiola or Klopp type of way. He's given him confidence. He's made him more relaxed, which, you know, these kind of intangible things that Ancelotti seems to bring to a club. And, you know, for him anyway, it's working. For some of the other players in the team, not so much. But Vinicius, you know, from Madrid's point of view, long may it last, because without him and without Benzema, they're really going to be in trouble.
Yeah, I agree. I think it is a confidence thing. I think it comes from playing regularly as well. And I think sometimes it is just a bit of luck in all senses of the word. And I don't know if I'm being a massive cynic here, because he is a Brazilian player who's capable of these flicks. But I think that I feel that second goal against Levante where he flicked it, I didn't know whether that was a cross and it actually crept in at the far post. But that's by the by. But just to sort of pin some numbers to that, as I say, or as Dermot said, that we did do a piece together looking at this change. And essentially for the past sort of three seasons, or the previous three seasons at Real Madrid, his expected goals was kind of hovering around 0.3 per 90. So he's essentially getting chances worthy of a goal every three games. But his actual output in that period was at about 0.2 goals per 90. So he was scoring at a rate of one every five games. So you can see that he was underperforming quite significantly over those three seasons, and that sort of adds up over time. But he's actually scored just over three goals above expectation this season. So you can just see, for whatever reason, it's just, as Dermot said, whether that's confidence, playing more regularly, he's scoring and performing above expectation, having previously underperformed. So that difference looks even more because of where he's sort of come from in previous seasons.
Certainly playing with confidence. I just this morning before we recorded saw him perform a successful rainbow flick in the by the corner flag in their game against Argentina last night.
Yeah, I didn't stay up to watch this, but it's exactly what I expect from Brazil against Argentina. Di Maria doing a nutmeg, Vinicius doing a rainbow flick, but the game ending 0-0 with quite a lot of bookings.
It certainly sounds like he is benefiting from Carlo Ancelotti's pure vibes approach. We're interested now in the approach that Xavi Hernandez will take as manager of FC Barcelona. Of course, the news breaking a few weeks ago, his first game in charge will be against Espanyol this weekend. Barcelona just one win in their last six in La Liga, ninth in the table, but the bad vibes banished for the moment at least. It seems to me that there is a genuine and large sense of excitement around this appointment from pretty much all angles, bar perhaps the Real Madrid media.
Yeah, it was super. There's a lot of excitement to see amongst us anyway, I think, to see what his first 11 is going to be, because Barca have a lot of players. Some of them have been out of favour. Koeman was getting a lot of hassle over his tactical selections, who he was playing, who he wasn't playing, the style of play. The idea that the hope amongst all the Barcelona fans, the illusion that they have is that he's going to be able to come in and maybe wave a bit of a magic wand or some Xavi dust and suddenly everything is fine again. His presentation was super strange. It was almost like he was presented like a new superstar signing. Mm. It was 10,000 people at the Camp Nou. The fans were singing. Laporta looked really happy. He was kind of joining in the singing. Those Madrid kind of cynical people here were pointing out, you know, it looks like they've won a trophy or something. All, you know, they've only won one in six. They're down in ninth. Why are they all so happy? And that's true. But Barca needed some kind of change, some kind of excitement, some shot of adrenaline and enthusiasm and excitement through the club. So we'll see. Tough game against Espanyol, a local derby. Espanyol are doing pretty well going into the game, level on points with Barca in the table, which doesn't always happen. And then they've got to play Benfica on Tuesday, which is, you know, kind of like a must win for them in the Champions League, or they could be out of it. So whether that wave of excitement is going to carry them through those two games is going to be super interesting to see. I'm going to both of them and really looking forward to it.
I noticed from your pieces on the appointment and his initial statements that more so than phrases around tactical philosophy and playing style and being, as you wrote, sort of positioning himself as the direct heir to former Barcelona players and the coaches, of course, in Pep Guardiola and Johan Cruyff, what stood out to me was quotes that seemed more like a head teacher than a football philosopher. Words like order and rules and demands, very much the order of the day in those sort of initial statements.
Yeah, it was a bit like Martin O'Neill had come into a club and was like, we have to sort out the dressing room. Everybody's got to arrive on time. We've got to be, follow the rules. You know, he's put in fines for when players show up late. Piqué, who's, has his second career as a Elon Musk type businessman, is... he's going to find that has been cut down a lot. Maybe that's a bit unfair on Piqué, actually, to be comparing him to Elon Musk. But, as a social media entrepreneur, a guy who says that he plays football in the morning and then goes to work in the office in the afternoon, that type of idea, Xavi, is just cutting the floor out from it completely. And he kind of referenced Guardiola. I think it might have been one of the questions, but he went along with it, that when Guardiola took over as Barcelona coach, that famous training camp in St. Andrews back in 2008. And, it was time for Ronaldinho to go. It was time for a much more serious approach to football. And the idea, I guess, is that if you follow the rules and if you follow the system and you do everything right, then the effect of that is that the team plays really good football on the pitch and everybody knows their job. They're well-drilled. They're well-trained. Again, that's the word out of the Barca dressing room over the last couple of years is that it has been a little bit slack, that standards have dropped, that the senior players were able to get away with too much. Now, Xavi, a lot of those senior players are his friends, they're his former teammates, there's people he's won a lot with. So he was pretty well, indirectly or directly signalling them and going like, this has to stop, things have to improve. Mm-hmm. So again, that dynamic is something we're going to be looking at on the side over the next couple of weeks. And it's something to... things could go really well, but also you can see the possibility for friction and for strife. And Barcelona is a place where, friction and strife and infighting and leaking and double speak, all that kind of stuff is come second nature to a lot of people. So it's going to be, it's going to keep you busy, I think, over the next couple of weeks. Barcelona are the gift that keeps giving for everybody, I think.
Martin O'Neill and Elon Musk mentioned in the same answer. I couldn't be happier about that. Michael, there's clearly a strong sense of nostalgia, excitement mixed with nostalgia for that all-conquering Barcelona side of Pep Guardiola, with Xavi perhaps his most important player not named Messi. You've written about this appointment and in particular about how the very nature of that team's success and their style of play, and therefore their legacy in the wider football game, might make it harder for Xavi to recreate things in the same way.
Yeah, I mean, they've just had as much influence on football as I think any side, arguably, in football history. I mean, you can point to the great sides of the last 30, 40 years. You can look at the Ajax of total football. You can look at Sacchi's Milan. But I just think these days, because footage is broadcast around the world more than ever before because of the internet, because of all the resources, I think so many clubs have tried to copy that Barcelona, Spain style of football. And Xavi was, I'd say, the most influential player in all that. So, yeah, it's not like he's going to come in and start a possession football revolution because that's already been done. But yeah, I'm excited to see how he does. I mean, obviously he's walking into a club that are at their lowest point for a couple of decades. But I think there's actually a lot to work with there. I mean, Xavi, of course, was a midfielder. He's going to be all about the midfield. And he's still got great quality in that position. I mean, Busquets is still a pretty top player. Frenkie de Jong has been spoken about repeatedly as maybe the next great, almost slightly revolutionary player in terms of the way he interprets midfield roles. They've got some really good young players with Pedri, with Gavi. There's some good players who have come through the youth system. And I think Nicolas Gonzalez as well looks a good little player. I think these are the kind of players that Xavi will want to be working with. Clearly, they need some individual quality in the final third, and it'll be a long time before they get over Messi. But because they don't have the great individuals, I think they need structure. And I think they need organisation and a philosophy. And I think Xavi could be the man to bring it.
Well, in order to work that out yourself for your article, you did watch a fair amount of his Al Sadd side, who he managed in Qatar for the last few years. What did you take from watching Xavi's Al Sadd? I mean, they are by far and away the richest club in that division and have quite the talent advantage over the rest of the league. But in terms of his tactical setup, what can you tell us?
Well, they play a very aggressive system that he refers to as a 3-4-3. I'd say it's a little bit more complex than that because the four in midfield is a box. So it's almost like 3-2-2-3. Very attack-minded. Yeah, like you say, I mean, it's difficult really to because they're so dominant, they're going to be playing an aggressive system. I mean, they just have the ability to do that. They dominate possession in every game. And of course, part of that is Xavi's philosophy, and part of it is just they've got better players and more wealth than any other side. But yeah, it has been interesting. Clearly, there's certain players in key positions that have a particular way of playing. The goalkeeper, whose name I've forgotten, sorry, was very two-footed. The centre-back seemed to be encouraged to really bring the ball forward, not just passing, but really dribbling into midfield. And then Santi Cazorla in midfield as well, which helped make them look like a real top side. But yeah, I'm sure it will be different once he has a... Now he has a different group of players to be working with, but certainly the midfield works. The way that worked was interesting, with a kind of box in that zone with three defenders and three attackers. So if he does something similar, that would be very exciting.
He referenced that, or he was asked about that at his presentation last week at the press conference, and he did say that the because playing three defenders is such a loaded kind of, there's been criticism of Coman for playing too defensively, and he was asked almost to try and catch him out. Are you going to play like you did at Al Sadd and play three at the back? And he kind of said not necessarily, but he said that Al Sadd is a completely different setup, that we are the dominant team, that we always had to just basically come up with a system to break everybody else down, that was the plan. Whereas at Barcelona, it's going to have to be a more balanced, and suggested that he play 4-3-3. And there was a good bit of talk that he's looking to bring in, or he wants to focus on anyway, wingers, that he wants to play the... a 4-3-3 with two guys who stay wide, who stretch the play, and that's been a big kind of focus, maybe where they're looking to sign somebody in January, or to get Dembele fit and firing again, or maybe bring in somebody from the youth system. Again, it's going to be super interesting to see, because he's got to go straight in at the weekend against Espanyol in a big game, and then against Benfica, so he doesn't have too much time to come up with, to reinvent the team really. It's just to try to come up with some tweaks and to make things work straight away.
Mark, performance-wise, you know, what are the key areas that Xavi needs to improve straight away to get Barcelona picking up wins and moving up the table?
Yeah, I think Dermot and Michael covered it well in terms of what kind of needs to change and what the resources are sort of there to work with at the moment. I think that one thing they don't need to really change is how much they hold on to the ball. They are the most dominant possession side in La Liga with 66% possession on average, which is actually the highest of any team in the top five European leagues. So Xavi will be pleased to know that they look after the ball. So it's just working what they do, I guess, with the ball. And as Michael said, I think it's just having that bit more kind of penetration in attack and a bit more clinical. And as Dermot said, Dembele is injured at the moment. Ansu Fati is, I don't know how long he's injured for, but I think he pulled up recently. He's got a muscle injury. So I think they need to have a bit more kind of, yeah, be more clinical in attack. I think they've been a bit unlucky in defence as well. We spoke about it before with Real Madrid's difference. I think that Barca have conceded three more goals more than they should have based on the quality of chances that they have conceded. And they've conceded 15 goals already. And I actually dug into the numbers historically. And when Xavi was at the peak of his powers, and so were Barcelona in the 2010-11 season, the whole of the La Liga season, they conceded just 21 goals that whole season, and they conceded 15 already. So you can see that, I mean, we were talking about one of the most historic teams of all time, but you can see now that teams don't fear Barcelona quite as much, and you can get at them in defence. And I mean, they were 3-0 up against Celta Vigo in, I think, their most recent La Liga game, and they ended up drawing 3-3. So that wouldn't have happened in Barca teams of old. So they need to get some fear factor back, I think, as well.
Dermot, just desperate to hear a little bit about this duo, Pedri and Gavi. Around the turn of the millennium, Xavi Hernandez himself broke into Barcelona's first team. And a few years later, Andres Iniesta joined him. They were an impossibly gifted, intelligent, technical duo. And together, they won everything that they could possibly have won multiple times in the case of many of those competitions. Now, at the start of last season, Pedri was signed by Barcelona and began to establish himself, at many comparisons to Andres Iniesta. And 1 year later, now Gavi has burst onto the scene for Barcelona. He's already got four Spain caps to his name in the last couple of months. So it strikes me you wait years for one diminutive, impossibly gifted, intelligent, technical midfielder. And in Barcelona's case, two tend to come along at once. They haven't played together that much yet due to Pedri's injury. I feel like a lot of Gavi's minutes came as a result of that. But are there discussions about how much they will play together once Pedri is fit and ready to play, and how they might complement each other on the pitch both now and in the future?
for sure. Like the Xavi and Iniesta comparison has been made lots of times here as well. And it does, you're always wary of hyping up kids too much when they come into the team. But Pedri had an amazing year, you know, at the Euros, he was phenomenal. And Gavi has just stepped in. Even more personality. Pedri is a phenomenal player. You wouldn't be criticizing him, but he is kind of a shy guy. He doesn't maybe grab the games by the scruff of the neck. It helps him a lot to have Busquets alongside him. And that. Whereas Gavi is younger, but he's got superman of personality. Real spiky. He gets back, gets his foot in as well. He's been booked a few times, arguing with opponents. But on the ball, like in the stadium at the Spain game at the weekend, there was a lot of criticism of Luis Enrique again from the Madrid end of pundits who don't really like him. Like, what's he doing putting this kid into the squad? Why isn't he playing? Why didn't he bring in Nacho or Lucas Vasquez? You know, why is he putting in Gavi instead? But his display against Italy in the first half on his debut was just unbelievable, how much he understands the game, how he knows where to go, the decisions he makes. And against Sweden at the weekend, he was Spain. Spain did lack a lot of incision, as Michael was saying. You know, they were happy enough maybe with nil all and then to win 1-0, but he was the guy who was grabbing the ball, who was dribbling past people in his own half, who was, you know, constructing the play, putting people into pockets of space, Jordi Alba a lot of the time as well, and just looks fantastic. The thing is, you know, what do you do now if you're going to play 4-3-3? You have Busquets, who's, you know, for Spain has shown, for Barca has looked, you know, he's been overrun quite often, but for Spain you can see that when the system of the team is right, when the shape of the team is right, he's still, you know, peerless really in that holding midfield role. Then you've got Frankie de Jong, who's, you know, one of the biggest talents, midfield talents in world football apparently, but hasn't shown it at Barca yet. And how do you put all them into it? So that's maybe one of the, for Xavi, it's one of the conundrums that he's going to face, and maybe a lot of how he'll be judged, maybe, or it's a way we can look at him and go, if he has clear ideas, what's he going to do? How's he going to imprint his personality on it? Is he going to ship Busquets out or move Frankie de Jong to the defence? Who knows?
Well, just to leave the Barcelona discussion behind, I'll read a piece from Michael's quote on the appointment, writing that these days several major clubs have convinced themselves that they have a traditional way of playing that necessitates appointing one of their former players as coach. The results of that have been mixed, but if it's likely to work anywhere, it is at Barcelona with Xavi. I feel like we are nailed on to be talking Xavi and Barcelona in the coming months, but we'll let him actually manage a game first and we'll move on, because this is the Athletic Football Tactics Podcast's La Liga Fiesta. And next up, we're tackling Simeone's title defenders, Newcastle's newest enemy, Emery, and Rayo going loco for Radamel Falcao. Stay right there. Time to talk Atleti now. Dermot, last year's title winners, of course. They've only lost one of their first 12 La Liga games, but probably two or three draws too many, you'd think. Six wins, five draws and a defeat. They're in fourth place at the moment. It's often said that winning a title is a huge challenge, defending it an even greater one. How do we rate Simeone's Atleti's start to the season?
It's been quite underwhelming, really. They've been unfortunate with injuries. First thing to say is they've been missing a lot of the most important players. Koke was out, Lamar's been out, Marcus Llorente's been out. That was their first choice midfield last year. Trippier's now done his shoulder, looks like he's out until the new year. At the back, they've had to keep changing, chopping and changing all the time as well. But it's a weird Atletico, because it's not, you look at the squad and it's very dissimilar from this idea of Atletico, which, you know, over the last decade, you've Godin, you've Gabi, you've Raul Garcia, they'll battle you, they'll be really well organised, they'll use every dark art at their disposal in order to win games. Diego Costa, you know, that's the kind of impression that everybody has. And it came out, those two games against Liverpool, I got a little bit annoyed with what I shouldn't have been, and ended up in Twitter spats with people about, you know, how Klopp described Atletico and how he spoke about them was as if he was watching a video of them from like 2 or 4 years ago. It wasn't like the game that he had just watched in front of him, or that was my impression anyway, because they have Lamar, Rodrigo de Paul has come in to play make. So they can, at times in those Liverpool games and at times in La Liga, they've played some really nice football. They've moved the ball around really well. They're not going to have 66% possession in a game. That's not going to happen. But they do play really neat triangles. They do move the ball fast. They switch the play. João Felix has been in really good form. Suarez has been scoring goals. So that part of their team has worked pretty well in most games. But at the back, they've been, you know, I was going to say shambolic, but the last game they were 3-1 up against Valencia with a couple of minutes left, and they conceded two goals. One of them to a free kick that Hugo Duro, who's not the tallest striker in the world, you know, gets a free header 6 yards out to equalise in added time, which is something that hopefully myself and Mark are going to be looking at next week on the site to see, you know, how Atletico have changed and the type of goals they're conceding. Because, you know, 3 goals against Valencia, 3 against Liverpool, it's like it's the worst run of goals conceded in their last 6 games in Simeone's entire decade. And that's their Achilles heel at the minute. If they were to be able to tighten that up, I would put them ahead of Madrid as favourites for the league. But so far, they haven't been. And it looks like a real worry for Simeone at the minute.
Michael, what have you made of Simeone's Atleti this season? It definitely feels like, and I agree with Dermot, if you're tuning in to an Atleti game with the image of Simeone's 13-14 title winners at the forefront of your mind, you're going to be pretty surprised about what you see in a tactical sense.
Yeah, I mean, let's start with the back three. I haven't been convinced by the way they've defended. I mean, particularly that game away at Liverpool. They lost 2-0, but it could have been much more. And the scorelines from their other last 6 games have been 2-3, 2-2, 2-2, 3-0 and 3-3. So yeah, it's a completely different side. I mean, the shape has been interesting. Last year it was generally 3-5-2. It's often been 3-4-3 in recent weeks. I think that's partly maybe because they've lost midfielders to injury, as Dermot says, and also they've just got more options up front than they have for quite a while with Correa, Griezmann, Felix, and of course Luis Suarez. So often there's been three of them in tandem, but I think it has left them a little bit exposed in defensive situations. And yeah, I think the injuries have played a part. I think they've missed the energy of Llorente, who I think had a really good season last time out. And Lamar as well. I mean, probably their standout result, even though Barcelona are not the side they used to be, but standout result, probably the 2-0 win over Barcelona. And both the goals featured Suarez and Lamar combining. And Lamar hasn't been available in recent weeks. They haven't had that option. So, yeah, they haven't been convincing. I think even some of their wins have been very last gasp. One of them, I think they won in the 98th minute or something, I seem to remember. So, yeah, it's quite an open season in La Liga. I mean, like you said earlier, Ali, Real Madrid the favourites. But I think there's a few sides who, if they just get themselves in shape, particularly Atleti, if they just get themselves in shape, bring back a little bit of the defensive solidity they used to have, I think they've got a real chance to retain their title, which should be the first time for God knows a very long time.
It definitely does feel like it's been quite a messy start to the La Liga season for a lot of clubs. Ironic given the absence of Messi for the first time in almost 2 decades. But Mark, in terms of Atleti's unusual or surprising looseness, I feel like the underlying numbers could give a little bit of hope, a little bit of light at the end of the tunnel on that front.
Yeah, no, I think that's interesting. I think this is why, as we always say with the numbers, the context is key. We're still very early on in the season. And as Dermot said, Atleti have had a lot of injuries. But yeah, if you were to just sort of look at it, if you hadn't have watched any of La Liga, to see who's sort of conceding the fewest shots as a sort of a proxy of who's kind of tightest at the back. Atleti have conceded the fewest shots per 90 in La Liga, 7.3 per 90, which is actually fewer at the moment. I know we're still early on, but fewer than last season's title winning campaign in terms of shots conceded. But I don't know if it's just a kind of a recency thing, because as Dermot quite rightly said, they've conceded 12 in their last 6 games in all competitions, which doesn't sound like a good defensive record. Of course it doesn't. So I guess that's the piece I think we're going to be doing, right, Dermot, to look at why that might be. So what it is that they're actually not conceding that many shots, but why is it that they are conceding so many goals, and dig a little bit deeper. I think the initial things that I kind of looked at is that they've got a really bad goals per shot on target sort of ratio of any side in La Liga, the worst in La Liga. So 0.39. So let's say 1 in 3 of the shots on target they have faced have actually resulted in a goal, which is that just poor luck? Is that a bad trend, or is that something kind of more systemically an issue? I think that's when we'll look more towards Jan Oblak, how he's been performing in terms of shot stopping, and dig a bit deeper. But I don't want to give too much away just now, because we've got a piece coming out soon.
In an interesting situation in their Champions League group as well, of course, with Liverpool on 12 points, maximum points from their 4 games, Porto on 5 and Atleti with 4. So work to do there as well. Dermot, you did write a piece the other day in which you opined that they are still probably Spain's best or most likely candidates to go deep in the Champions League. We know that Simeone is more than comfortable in the latter stages of that particular competition. Let's talk about Villarreal and Unai Emery, who himself is pretty comfortable in the latter stages of European competition, more specifically the Europa League, of course. Dermot, a few weeks now since the Newcastle Unai Emery saga ended up with Emery staying at Villarreal, what's the fallout been? It was a pretty emotional few days, it seemed, from the piece you wrote around the club, but with a bit of water under the bridge now, how is the dust settling and other various cliches?
Yeah, it was just very awkward for Emery. The TV interview that he did on the night of the game after they'd won, when the whole day had been spent, you know, people in England were sure, some of our colleagues were sure, they'd been told that he was definitely taken over at Newcastle. That was really, really awkward, and it didn't go down well. Villarreal, you used the word family club. Villarreal is close to a family club, maybe at the top of European football, because they are owned by the president, Roig. His son is the chief executive of the club. They own the club themselves. It's kind of a small group of people who are there at the top, and Emery's relationship with them had been super strong. They'd gone for him. He was their guy. They'd given him more power than coaches normally have at Villarreal over transfers and over everything in the club. And in a way, he was very close to betraying them. And I think they put a little bit of emotional, I'm going to say emotional blackmail, mm-hmm. is not fair, but they just kind of pointed out, like, you can't leave us like this.
It definitely felt that way from the quotes that you had in your piece. It felt like a lot of, a bit of guilt tripping involved.
So he upset people, and he upset people in the dressing room as well. Maybe players are more able to understand, you know, they themselves would have to think about what would happen if Newcastle came calling for them. But the reporters around the club, the staff, just a few people that you'd know, were surprised that Emery was thinking about leaving. Again, they could understand, you know, the millions of reasons why, but also were just a little bit upset. So they had a bit of a cathartic win. They won that game in the Champions League. Then they won in La Liga the weekend afterwards. It was a decent performance. It was only their third win in La Liga of the season, which has been obviously a problem for them. So everybody's trying to, hoping to put it behind them and maybe just not talk about Newcastle for a while, just move on. And they've got a big game against Man United coming up in the Champions League as well. So in football, people do tend to look forward and move on. But again, if we'd spoken a month ago, I would have said Emery's super solid there. He won the Europa League last year. You know, he's putting in place, you know, the foundations to go on and build something important there. That's taken a step back, so things are a little bit more shaky, and we'll have to see how it rolls out over this season.
It is an interesting situation, isn't it? Especially because they're going well in the Champions League, top of that group, but they have got United and Atalanta still to play, and so those two fixtures are going to really decide on whether they go any deeper into the Champions League. They're 12th in the La Liga table at the moment, which I suppose would be an underperformance so far based on where they'd expect to be. And it's a record where they've won 3 and lost 3. They've drawn 6, so half of their games draws in La Liga so far. And my automatic question when there's a team that's drawing a disproportionate amount of games is, based on the performances and perhaps the underlying numbers, are those draws more likely, Dermot, do you think, to turn into wins? Or are they often the case where they're sort of clinging on and they're losing draws, if you will? What's your instinct there?
I would say wins for sure. They've missed Gerard Moreno, who's, you know, their top scorer, got more than 30 goals last season, is one of the many players who were run into the ground last year, yeah, and then in the summer, and have now, you know, had difficult starts to this season through injuries. And Villarreal in some moments have looked really good. I was at the Bernabeu for a game. They drew 0-0 with Madrid, but they hammered Madrid in that game. You know, they really could have been 2-3-0 up. You know, the game at Old Trafford against Manchester United, you know, they had, maybe if Moreno was there or if somebody else was a bit more clinical, they would have won that. At Atletico Madrid, they were 2-1 up going into the 97th minute, something like that. And there's a comical, crazy own goal from Mandy. There's been a couple of other times they've given away penalties, given away late goals. With Emery, there wasn't a feeling that things were really going that badly, that the numbers, the points that they had in the table weren't a fair reflection of how well they played. And they still kind of assumed that they were going to get back into the top four race. Generally, their performances have been a lot better than their results. And the people at the club, that's what they feel. You speak to people, you know, close to the dressing room, the players there, they weren't unhappy with how things have been going. They just felt they'd been unlucky. And when they get their Gerard Moreno back, Pareco was injured as well, Chukwueze, who's an important player, when these guys got back, they felt that they would, you know, should get through their Champions League group and should move back up towards the top four in La Liga.
Michael, that they are so far after a dozen La Liga games, a heavily possession-based team, and they also have the lowest PPDA number per the Opta analyst site in La Liga. That suggests a pretty intense press. Is that typical of Unai Emery?
I'm not sure it is, really. I remember when he came to Arsenal in his first press conference, he said he believes in positive football and he believes in possession, he believes in pressing high. And having watched his team for just over a year, I thought that statement felt, in hindsight, more like kind of PR rather than an actual declaration of his intentions, because I don't think Arsenal really were particularly impressive in either respect. But I mean, it's quite interesting. He's played a variety of systems in recent weeks. He's gone to kind of a box midfield at times, which he has used. He did use a bit last season in Villarreal, actually. I remember the best Villarreal side I've seen probably was 10 years ago when they used a similar system. But, I mean, he's really packing like four central midfielders into that team. At times with Francis Coquelin in notionally one of the more advanced midfield roles, tucked inside from the left, which, he's not the most creative player I've ever seen in one of those positions. Yeah, I must say I haven't seen a great deal with him, and I wonder whether the high possession stat is partly because of the game state, and they've very rarely been ahead, so they've got to kind of force the issue. They've had 4-0s, so it might be a consequence of how the games have gone rather than a real intention from Emery, I suppose.
Their game at the Bernabeu in October, I'm going to say, was one of the most interesting games I've been to this season, because Villarreal were super well drilled, especially playing the ball out from the back and the automisms that they have and how they were going to move the ball up the pitch compared to Madrid, who were the complete opposite. And Ancelotti told them, okay, we're going to press them high, we're going to run after them. But you could see Villarreal and the keeper, Rulli, would like wait on the ball until Benzema or Vinicius tempt somebody out to him, and then he'd play it outside to Pau Torres and they'd move it up the pitch. And Madrid just fell into their trap again and again and again. It was almost embarrassing from Madrid's point of view to watch. And in the stadium, the fans were starting to whistle. They were starting to get on the back of the Madrid players because they could see how Emery was just outthinking, or the Villarreal team were outthinking the Madrid team. And I guess it was the same at Old Trafford. You know, they come up against a similar type of a team in United. But again, that day, they weren't able to take their chances. Danjuma, who's been really good for them, had a couple of chances and he was a bit unlucky. But they weren't able to. There were times when they had, you know, wide open spaces to attack into, but maybe it was people like Coquelin who were getting on the ball in advanced positions and then, you know, weren't able to do enough with it at that stage. But they looked really well drilled that day. They looked one of the best organised teams who knew, each player knew what their job was, knew where their teammates were going to be when they got possession, what they were going to do, which was quite impressive, I thought.
I think that's interesting as well in terms of the overall performance of Villarreal versus kind of, again, I always come back to the hard, cold numbers and stuff, but like that feeling that you get in terms of take from the performance, kind of what you will. When looking at the numbers, their performances at either end in terms of their expected goals is kind of about what you'd expect them to be overall. I know you're speaking about some chances that they might have missed sort of individually, Dermot, but over the course of the dozen games, they are about where they should be in terms of goals or chances created and conceded compared with their goals. I thought it was interesting what you said about kind of the turning the sort of the high press into a shot, because I looked into their high turnovers that do end in a shot. So high turnovers essentially being winning the ball back in there or thereabouts the final third, and how many of those times that you know actually ends in a shot. And they've had just 5 so far this season, which is the lowest of any side in La Liga. And sort of for context, Real Betis have the highest on 24 so far this season. So I don't know whether it kind of tallies with sort of what you were saying before, Dermot, in terms of they might win the ball back, but not necessarily have that kind of intensity to go and actually kind of do something quickly in transition and have that urgency in attack. Is it more about, again, coming back to that performance of actually having dominance kind of on the ball, but not necessarily being kind of peppering the goal, so to speak?
No, that is interesting. Almost like they're too controlled, that they're following orders too much, and then they don't have that individual spark to do something something to look into. Haven't done a piece on them for a good while, so you know, we'll keep in touch.
Yeah.
See about that.
Feels like the fitness of Gerard Moreno, his reintroduction into the team would surely help that. He is someone that gets a lot of shots off, and we know him to be a pretty sensational finisher when he's on form. The final team we're going to talk about are Rayo Vallecano, who are managed by Andoni Iraola. The listeners will know him for being almost a one-club man as a player, a whole lifetime spent with Athletic Bilbao before a sabbatical with New York City FC for a season to finish. His managerial career has been a little more diverse. AEK Larnaca, his first job, then Mirandes, and now Rayo Vallecano. Last week, we spoke about Venezia, who'd been promoted through the playoffs in Serie B, and their Spanish equivalent this season is Rayo, who won the playoffs in the Segunda. Dermot, they always feel like a fascinating club to me on so many levels. This season, no different.
Yeah, it's great to have him back in La Liga. From a personal point of view, to be able to go to the games and to with fans back in the stadiums as well, it's been super. And Falcao, just been an amazing story. You know, there's a lot of skepticism both inside Rayo's dressing room and at the club and outside about whether Falcao, you know, whether it was an ego signing from the president or what state he was going to arrive in. But he's been super, scored some amazing goals, scored that goal against, scored within like 10 minutes of his debut, then scored a winner at San Mamés against Athletic Bilbao, scored a winner against Barcelona. He's got injured again, but he's just been really, really good. And Iraola is, you know, he's maybe the most interesting young Spanish coach. You know, played under a lot of different coaches at Athletic Bilbao, including Marcelo Bielsa. Then he has that Man City link. Larnaca is an interesting club as well because there are a good few ex-Barcelona coaches and directors have gone through Larnaca, including Jordi Cruyff, I'm pretty sure, who's back at Barca at the minute. And then you've got the Man City link with New York City as well. So I think he's definitely one to watch. Did really well at Mirandes, did a run in the Copa del Rey, knocked out a couple of Premier League teams, and then got Rayo up at the first time of asking last season, and is doing really well with them. They don't play the typical Rayo, you know, maybe from Paco Gemes' time, people might remember, where they were super possession-based. You know, that time when they had more possession than Barca, but lost 4-0, I think, in one game. And then the Barca coach, I think it was Valverde, maybe no, Martino, got a lot of abuse from his own fans and pundits because they'd lost the possession stats even though they'd won the game. And that was a typical Paco Gemes type of a thing to do. Iraola is more, he's more out of the Athletic Bilbao school, maybe more Bielsa as well, more direct, more physical, but they go for a goal, they win the ball high, they go straight for a goal, and having Falcao up front then makes it, you know, is perfect for him to take the chances that they make.
What, Michael, or who is standing out to you when it comes to Rayo? It can't just be about Radamel Falcao.
No, but that 1-0 win over Barcelona, I thought, was very typical of how they play. There was a high win with Trejo dispossessing Busquets, one pass in behind to Falcao, who scored the winner, scored the only goal. And that is typical of them. They're third in pressures across the pitch in La Liga. In terms of assists, I know I've talked a lot about assists in this podcast, but only Benzema's ahead of Trejo. So far this season, he's playing that number 10 role just behind Falcao. So he's having a very good season as well. And yeah, they do seem very very hardworking, very energetic, force the issue, high tempo. And yeah, I think it kind of, to me, that is almost more suited to the kind of club that Rayo are than the possession style. Just their ground and the way it's so kind of compact and old school feels like they should always be a very hardworking side, Rayo.
I don't have too much to offer in terms of too much value, but I just think it's quite a fun sort of statistical quirk and something which I'm sure a lot of the listeners will hopefully enjoy hearing. And I want to speak about Bebe, who famously was at Manchester United, probably one of Manchester United's not so good signings, I think it's fair to say, but playing for Vallecano. And he has the highest volume of shots per 90 of any forward in the top five European leagues, which I think is super interesting. He's had 10 appearances, but only one start. So he's only had 190 minutes played in La Liga. So seemingly comes on and just, I guess, shoots on sight at the nearest opportunity. I was doing something on this fairly recently where essentially he's had 6.2 shots per 90 on average, and we're talking ridiculously small, you know, numbers in terms of minutes played. But the average expected goals value of his shot is 0.03. So he's having a ton of shots at really poor quality and just having a bit of a shoot on sight, which I think is sort of indicative of how we sort of think of him or thought of him at Manchester United as well, which is maybe not the highest quality. But I just thought it was a fun sort of statistical quirk just to offer my 10 cents.
Alessandro Diamante reincarnated and playing for Rayo. That's it for our Spanish vacation on this week's Athletic Football Tactics podcast. A huge thank you to Dermot Corrigan for joining us, to Michael and to Mark Carey as well for sprinkling their expertise across this episode. Dermot's coverage of La Liga on The Athletic is absolutely recommended, appointed reading, in fact. Certainly his coverage of Xavi's appointment at Barcelona has been excellent, but really captures the specifics, the quirks of Spanish football, the emotion, of course, but also the football and the tactics as well, so brilliantly. So do sign up to The Athletic if you don't already subscribe, and you can read all of Dermot's writing as well as that of Mark and Michael. TheAthletic.com/tactics is the place to go for 33% off an annual subscription. I really hope you're enjoying our tour of Europe's top leagues on the pod. Next week, we're off to Germany with Rafa Honigstein. Cannot wait for that one. But it's goodbye for now, and thanks as ever for joining us on the Athletic Football Tactics podcast.
The Athletic.